Hello, and welcome to the Brad Pitt Cast, the podcast about Brad Pitt. My name's Dan Dixon.
My name's Joseph Earp.
And today we are here to talk about Spy Game, and we have a guest.
We do have a guest.
In person.
In person.
Everyone's seeing each other again.
You're our second ever in-person guest.
Am I, like, after the restrictions have eased?
Yes, you're our, like, first post-restriction guest.
Yeah. So we're all sitting 1.5.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, kind of, right? It's Sam Twyford Moore, an author and critic. I was like, you write very intelligently about Hollywood pop culture sometimes, but it's usually Hugh Jackman, right?
Yeah.
To talk about Hugh Jackman first.
I saw Hugh Jackman posted a selfie of himself on Twitter with no context recently. That was very exciting.
It was pretty good.
I saw that too, yeah. He's just like happy that he was looking good. Well, apparently he's in the new Michael Mann movie.
Oh, that's exciting.
Is that Netflix? Yeah, I don't know. Who knows where he's getting his money from, but... a couple of years ago last year I wrote a piece about Hugh Jackman, which is sort of in the similar vein to what you guys are doing here, which was I sat down and watched pretty much all of his movies, at least the ones I could find, because he was doing this big arena stadium tour called My Life, My Work or something like that, and it just provided this kind of interesting inroads into looking at someone's career as a whole. And I'd actually done it the year before with Russell Crowe, because remember Russell Crowe had that like exhibition at Sotheby's, he was selling off all this stuff as part of his divorce. Yeah. So I went along to that and was just totally bemused by it and tried to figure out, you know, like...
Oh, I think I read that.
Yeah.
I remember that piece. It was great.
Good.
Yeah,
good.
It was really compelling.
That is the only two things that I've written for the last 2 years. So that's the body of my work at the moment.
Jackman is interesting because he's a good example maybe of an artist who, like, I don't know if he's found his counterpart who sees him for who he is, the way that Pitt meets someone like Fincher, right? Like, who's the guy who sees Hugh Jackman and goes... Oh, I know every element of your stardom, and I know how to use you.
It's probably... Who was the director who did the last Wolverine things?
Oh.
James Mangold.
James Mangold.
Yeah, who had the funniest part of it was he'd done Kate and Leopold in 2001,
that's
like
right.
The romantic comedy, and then like circled around to doing the Wolverine and Logan. I suppose he'd done the action star Jackman and the kind of the romantic hero. But I think in that piece I sort of settled on, Jackman kind of found himself in The Greatest Showman, which I think is the ultimate Jackman role, because it brings in, you know, some of the dramatic stuff, the leading man stuff, and then the musical stuff. So
I feel like we as a culture don't often enough talk about how weird The Greatest Showman effect is, that like it tanked and then it just would not stop like climbing the box office charts,
and then it came back strong.
Yeah, extremely strong.
I have one of the most baffling conversations I've ever had with friends of mine who are a couple. I won't say who they are. I don't think they listen, and this is probably fine. But they had decided, like, to formalize, just because they were both very busy, doing something nice for each other every week. Like, a thing, like one would do a thing for the other. They would sit, take time. And it was a man and a woman, and the man, the favor he asked is that his partner would watch The Greatest Showman with him. which he did not enjoy, apparently. Which is such a... I remember... My only experience with that film is seeing the song performed at the Oscars.
Right.
Did they perform the song at the Oscar? I don't remember
that. They did.
That.
The song from it was nominated, and they had like all the show people come out semi-problematically, I think.
I mean, the film pretends that there's nothing problematic going on. That's probably the funniest thing about that film.
Yeah.
Is it's like, this is a story of a man finding himself.
No, totally. And like, they could have made that movie without it being about P.T. Barnum. I mean, for me, it's just like a kind of semi-Hugh Jackman autobiography.
Yeah,
set in the 1800s for no reason.
Why doesn't Brad Pitt do a musical? I mean, he can't sing, right?
He sings
in Johnny Suede, doesn't he?
That's right, but badly, right?
Badly, yeah, extremely badly.
I guess that's the problem.
He just can't do
it. He couldn't do the Les Miserables style on set recorded.
No, Russell Crowe shouts singing. We're here to talk about Spy Game. Well, my candle looks like it's setting
smoky.
Something on fire.
Yeah. We had candle content last week.
I know,
as well,
we
I
did.
Think, yeah.
I know. The same candle.
Okay.
It's a reoccurring character. We're here to talk about Spy Game, which Dan and I were briefly talking before we started recording, that I think this is a good film. Dan unsurprisingly thinks it's a bad film. But I think it's the most interesting film we've had to talk about in quite a while.
Right.
What's your... Because you saw it at the cinema, you were saying.
I have a vague memory that I saw this at the cinema. I mean, when did it come out? 2001? Mm. I either saw it at the cinema or I saw it on DVD or VHS, like, quite soon, you know, as soon as it kind of came out. I was sort of into spy movies as a kid, so... This is the most obviously appealing title of all time, Spy Game, which would have been the reason that I probably saw it in the cinema. I wasn't rocking up for Brad or Bobby.
No? Were you a Brad fan as a kid?
No, I was thinking about this on the walk over here. I don't think Brad Pitt was really in movies that I could access as a kid. Like, I think he was in mostly, like, really quite adult stuff.
Mm.
I have two memories. One is my mum went, which was really rare. My mum went with her female friends to go see Legends of the Fall and totally swooned over it. And I think she came home, like, late that night, and then the next morning I woke up and she told me about this Brad Pitt guy. So that's probably my first memory of Brad Pitt.
That's amazing.
And I think I had an older cousin who had a poster of Interviews with a Vampire
mm-hmm.
on the wall. And so, you know, those kind of movies weren't for my age group at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And then probably 14 or 15, Fight Club comes out and, yeah. you know, and then you're kind of like watching this stuff. But it did feel like he was... One, had super long hair, and two, was in, like, stuff that you weren't allowed to watch.
Yeah.
Adult film star.
Yeah,
It's interesting. I was reading about Sinbad and The Legend of the Seven Seas, which we've got to deal with three episodes. Okay. Ocean's 11 is the next Thank film God. He makes after this. Very strange period of his career. But he says the reason why he wanted to do Sinbad was because he was like, my nieces and nephews can't see my movies.
Right.
Because there's too much chopping off of heads, which is what he said in this interview. And I don't think
there's
like,
been any chopping off of heads so far.
In any of his movies.
He doesn't chop it off. Yeah. Surely that's what he's referring to.
I guess. That must make sense. It's very bizarre to me that this Spy Game is a post-Fight Club movie in Pitt's career. This feels to me like, you know, we were 4 or 5 episodes ago, we were contending with films like Sleepers. Have you ever seen Sleepers? Like weird crime drama.
The Devil's Own.
Yeah, these like adult contemporary thrillers.
I think we describe them as films that your parents get a babysitter to go see. Right.
Yeah. Legends of the Fall.
Exactly. Yeah. It's this sort of kind of prestige-y, expensive, very 90s, pre-9/11 stuff.
I guess you guys are reckoning with this, but like, do you think he's a star in the 90s? Or like, when do you think he like hits...
It's definitely true that he can appear in movies that should not make money at the box office, and his appearance means that they do.
Right.
Like, the 3-hour-long... Death in the Body of like a male suitor comedy Meet Joe Black should not be a success, but I think Brad Pitt is the guarantor of that film's box office success.
Right.
But he, I mean, stardom...
He has very few films in which he is the Brad Pitt we think of as Brad Pitt.
That's what like we're finding. That really he's... I mean, he's even in Spy Game, to be honest. It's really Robert Redford's movie in some ways, right? Yeah. Like, he is the... He's in flashback. You barely see him in the present except for being kind of beaten up. So I don't even know if he's the draw card for this film for audiences.
No. It doesn't feel like he's in it.
No. No.
And it's not... Yeah, it's not a very charismatic or interesting performance. It was like, am I coming for the Brad Pitt podcast or the Robert Redford? I hope it's the latter.
Well, we did being John Malkovich, which is in for 0.5 seconds or something. So just any Brad Pitt will go for.
After the film was over, I was trying to evaluate Pitt's performance, and I was just going, there's not a lot to evaluate. He's in a single mode, really. He's in kind of good guy, wants to do the good thing, but is shackled by the system kind of mode, like youthful renegade, I guess.
Yeah.
Because the scenes that stick out most in my memory when it's done are that this kind of romance subplot he has with a young aid worker.
Which turns out, the entire film turns out to hinge on that, which I didn't expect it to.
No, I didn't expect it to either. I mean, so much to talk about. The first thing I think we could talk about was what this film self-consciously wants to refer to, which is paranoid thrillers of the 70s, to the extent that Robert Redford is famous for being in at least two of the most famous of those movies, like 3 Days of the Condor and All the President's Men. And they deliberately style him here like he is styled in 3 Days of the Condor. Like, he has the same glasses and the same, like, adult contemporary wintry outfit. But this film is not a 70s paranoid thriller in any fashion but the aesthetics. Right? This film is not politically grim at all. It's not about corruption, really. Do you think it's about corruption, I guess?
I don't know what it's about.
It's not concerned with politics.
No. Not, well, like, it touches on geopolitics, obviously, because of, you know, what it's set up as and the flashbacks, where the flashbacks occur, but it says nothing meaningful.
It culminates in an incident which could plausibly spark World War III, and it is glossed over.
Yeah.
It really is glossed over.
Yeah. Well, part of the reason that Brad Pitt's performance is so nothing in this film is he's restricted by the flashbacks. But the flashbacks themselves are so inert. Like, the three locations, what it's Vietnam, China, and Beirut, are all just so, like, anonymously dressed. And the core of the film is this back room, like, single 12 hours or whatever that Robert Redford's living in the CIA, like, this anonymous office. And that's where the exciting stuff in the film happens. Mm. It's really strange movie.
It's contained almost exclusively to a single boardroom. And yeah. Robert Redford migrating between that and his office, which gets ransacked.
Various hallways.
Yeah.
As you say, I think the most astonishing thing about this film is it does have action scenes, kind of. There's a scene with Brad Pitt trying to make it to a chopper, right?
Then there's one extended action scene with the bomb in Beirut. Actually, something interesting. We'll have to talk about the plot in a second, because I at least don't want to encourage our listeners to seek out this film. But I think I rented this film on YouTube to watch it. Mm. And one of the recommended videos I saw just as I finished watching it was the sniper scene where he takes out some Vietnamese general or something, North Vietnamese general, in, like, the earliest flashback of Pitt. And it had over 2 million views.
Really?
Which makes me think maybe there's kind of an American militaristic fetishization thing.
And people finish watching American Sniper and then they're looking for... But that scene's so flat.
I know.
Like, it's not well directed, and it feels it's on some backlot somewhere. Like, it's not atmospheric or...
You don't understand the stakes,
it's
really.
It's so washed out, the look of it as well.
That, I think that's the interesting comparison point, again, to 70s paranoid thrillers, right? That I watched, like, 3 Days of the Condor and Parallax View, which I watched, that this film self-consciously wants to be both of those films in some ways. Like, Parallax View was directed by Alan J. Pakula, who made The Devil's Own, which Brad Pitt is in. So I think there's, like, a conscious attempt to be like, we are making a film in that vein. Kind of. But those films have set pieces of increasing intensity.
Mm.
And this film does have set pieces, but they're some of the least tense action filmmaking I think I've ever seen.
Yeah. And they're just disjointed flashbacks. Like, it just renders it inert. The forward momentum's all in these boardrooms. It's really hard not to keep going back to that point, but it's a strange movie.
Well, because the boardroom stuff is the best stuff, right? And the boardroom stuff, I think, is actually good and compellingly directed.
Well, it's also where you understand why Robert Redford is a movie star, right? Because there's a bunch of relatively boring suits sitting around the table, and then Robert Redford is being interesting.
Do you guys describe the plots of these movies? Because, I wouldn't even know how to describe the plot of this movie to make, sense.
I'm worried about this.
We forced Dan to do a game where he describes the plot in 4 sentences.
Oh my god, this is impossible. So, for this movie, you could do it for some of the other ones.
Yeah. Dan, it stresses it.
It doesn't really stress me out.
Do you want to do it?
Since I refused to do it for our last film, I guess I have to now. Brad Pitt is caught while attempting to undertake some spy operation in a Chinese prison, and I'll just leave that as one sentence, because I think I can if I just wipe out a lot of stuff from the rest of the
plot.
That's
very ambitious. Three sentences.
Robert Redford, a CIA officer back in Washington, where's the CIA again?
I think Washington.
Virginia? Anyway, discovers that Pitt has been kidnapped Pitt has been taken by Chinese forces and wants to free him at the... wants to free him despite pushback from everyone in the office around him, and in order to do so has to undertake a series of internal kind of subversive espionage tactics from within the CIA out of the view of his superiors.
Yes, excellent.
So that they're glossing over.
Well, because, yeah, like, I mean, this would be a fascinating, like, tight 90-minute movie if you remove the flashbacks and you just have it be that, like, his machinations and, like, covert operations within, like, the CIA within a single room and his office. Like, it's fascinating.
Yeah.
Well, it's a two-hour film. Yeah. Right? Which is not...
You don't need Brad Pitt. You don't need the flashbacks.
I think that's really true.
The plot unfolds as a series of flashbacks in which Redford recounts the development of his relationship with Pitt through various CIA operations, culminating in a... failed operation in Beirut, which brings to a head the conceptual conflict between Pitt and Redford's character, which has to do with the kind of brutal tactics of the CIA.
That's never played well either, where it's like the core conflict in the flashback kind of stuff should be, you know, and the kind of meta element that I thought this film had in it was like, I like the idea of, you know, a generational swap.
Mm-hmm.
That there's kind of like Robert Redford is conferring onto Brad Pitt, you are the new Robert Redford. But it has none of that because it's not built in. They don't have any chemistry. And then it's not built into, you know, there's no stakes with what should be the biggest stakes of the film, which is their ideological kind of differences and their sort of different approaches to spy warfare.
Yeah.
One which is really blunt and quite violent, and Pitt who... you know, has within him a kind of empathy for the people that he's dealing with, whereas Robert Redford's very much, you know, trading lives or whatever.
Like a realist pragmatist.
It's there a little bit, but it disappears pretty quickly. And the final kind of climax of it is just not there, I don't think.
Yeah, I think that's how I interpret it. So I've got one sentence left. Through the flashbacks, it is revealed that Brad Pitt developed a relationship that Redford disapproved of with a woman in Beirut, which proves to be the reason that he is in the Chinese prison. He pursued her. There are a lot of sub-clauses here. He pursued her there, and Redford, through various kind of obscure strategies within the CIA, manages to send in an American, like, SEAL task force to infiltrate a Chinese prison and free both Pitt and the woman who was sent to this prison for some reason, and Pitt pursued her there.
Yeah.
Long sentences.
You kind of get the feeling that maybe part of it was like you get a star like Redford and that character is more unlikable and like that kind of heightens the conflict between the two of them. But I feel like Robert Redford's probably someone who wants to be likable and can't help but be kind of charming in his performance. And so you lose that edge that might have been there otherwise. My misremembering of this film was that Robert Redford was the villain or something, like revealed. Mm. It was revealed, but I'm obviously thinking about another movie.
I mean, I guess he's the villain in the Avengers movie, right?
Yeah, he gets that sort of sinister sort of track later on.
Which one is that?
Civil War, the one that wants to be a paranoid 70s thriller.
Oh, no, I haven't seen that, sorry. Yeah. Okay, that's why.
And Redford ruined the twist ahead of time. He said in like a promo interview months before the film came out, he was like, I liked playing a villain for once, and it was like, that twist comes like 3/4 into the
Very funny.
I mean, that's the thing to say, I guess, about Redford, amongst other things, is I watched this film and I was like, Redford's so charming. And I was really taken. I was like, I really enjoy watching Robert Redford on screen. And I was thinking, he's the standout performance. And then I rewatched 3 Days of the Condor almost immediately afterwards. And I realized like, oh, 3 Days of the Condor is Redford trying. He's not really trying in Spy Game. He's a little bit on autopilot.
Well, then what's Brad Pitt doing? Because, like, Redford's performance is so much better in this than Brad Pitt's performance.
I think,
like,
Pitt is just totally hamstrung by the fact that his character is the do-gooder in quite a frustrating way. I think I was trying to work out why. I mean, Pitt is in his most mechanical role here. Has he ever been so colourless before? Maybe last time was Devil's Own.
Oh, yeah, or Sleepers, maybe. He's a little colourless in Sleepers. I think there's two scenes where Pitt is okay in this film, and I think it's at the cafe when Redford approaches him and the woman he's in a relationship with, and then afterwards when he's confronting her, discovering that she might be playing him as an asset in order for her own ends, despite him having originally found her because he was using her for his own mission. And I kind of enjoyed Pitt in those scenes. It felt... The way he was playing the character felt plausible and real to me. And there was some kind of emotional heft and stakes in the scenes because in the cafe, Redford approaches them pretending for it to be a coincidence, but in fact has kind of arranged to be there because he wants Pitt, this woman, to... He thinks Pitt is this woman is compromising Pitt's role in the mission. Redford kind of starts revealing these things about the woman that Pitt doesn't know. Her confusing backstory. And Pitt gets upset at Redford's intervention. And that is, like, an interesting point of conflict. There's an insane scene that Joe and I talked about just before you came, Sam. Pitt and Redford are on the top of a roof, and the camera's, like, swinging around them as if it's on, like, being swung by a
camera thrower. That scene's so pivotal. It was the only one that I kind of remembered, and I think because it's so, like, aesthetically crazy. I mean, I'm sure you'll talk about Tony Scott a lot. It's the only scene that feels super, like, Tony Scott.
Yeah.
But there's something central to that scene that really... brought to the front of my mind the kind of that generational thing, and like why I don't think Pitt fits in this movie is that, I mean, that's not only is it the most bombastically filmed scene in the film, but it's the most bombastic dialogue of like the kind of title coming up sort of style of dialogue where it's like, this is the spy game, you can't lose this game, this is a game that you cannot lose or whatever. And Redford can sell that dialogue. Like, you kind of suddenly go, okay, if this is the 70s kind of, you know, conspiracy thriller sort of thing, Redford is versed in that, and Pitt just kind of looks lost. Like, he tosses a chair off the
literally off the roof.
Probably kills some bystander. And he just, like, yeah, he has the kind of end of Seven sort of flip out, and that's all he kind of has in his toolbox for that scene, which is only to say he can't sell something that, like, kind of crusty and kind of cliched.
It's interesting because I think sometimes we struggle to remember recent films we've watched starring Brad Pitt. And I'm sure there are, like, at least a handful, maybe half a dozen films at which something is revealed to Pitt and Pitt is angry that it wasn't revealed to him earlier. I think that's a classic Pitt trope where he's like aghast. Mm-hmm. And he's like, why didn't you tell me?
I mean, it's the plot point of Seven, right?
Yeah, well, like, there. Seven is kind of the classic, right?
Yeah.
This happens like four times in Spy Game, but each time you don't really feel the stakes of it.
Yeah, and Redford gets to like suck up all the energy of it because he's like sitting down on a roof with like, does he have a coffee and a cigarette or something?
Yeah.
And he's just enjoying himself and he gets all the fun stuff, you know, back at home. Like, Pitt has kind of like grimy, heavy lifting to do in this that just doesn't look like much fun.
Mm.
I think the only thing that marks this as a post-Fight Club film is that you see Pitt get beaten up, which happens a bunch after Fight Club.
That's true.
People realise that it's fun to watch Brad Pitt have blood all over him.
Yeah. And maybe that's actually, like, there's a bit of, like, kind of fun, you know, what's going on at the start, even though it's kind of grimily filmed, sort of in the prison, and, you know, like, he's doing some tricks there, like... putting the gasoline on his hand so he doesn't get burnt when he fakes his own death. I mean, there's some, you know, there's a little bit at the start, but then he's sent off into the past.
I bet it was his choice to throw the chair off the roof. There's no way he wasn't like, I need to do something in this
it
scene.
It doesn't make any sense. Then there's the other roof scene where he's following the guy. And he's like, he's just like a pretty bad spy because he's like in shot all the time. He's just following this guy like running across the roof. It's like, I don't think this guy's really a spy.
Also, when he and Redford have to run through a war zone in order to get breakfast.
Yeah. Like a very odd detour.
So strange.
It is funny that the 70s paranoid thriller as a genre has something of a history of rooftop stuff, because Parallax View starts with an assassin falling off the Space Needle in Seattle in like this very upsetting scene. So they're like rooftops.
Are they on the rooftop? They're like a Fuji film.
You can see the Fuji film.
They sponsored it, maybe.
Well, yeah, there's a roof in one of the Hong Kong shots that's Panasonic. So maybe that was their product placement.
It is, I mean, the rooftop scene is a good time to introduce, as you say, Sam, Tony Scott, the director of this film, who we have covered once before because Scott is the director of True Romance, which Brad Pitt is in for 6 minutes, you know.
As in a great, a lot of fun stoner, kind of, with James Gandolfini briefly, which is amazing.
And Scott back then was in a very different mode, I think. Because that film is like a Tarantino script and Scott being flashy music video, kind of very kinetic. But we have hit... I'm going to find the filmography exactly so I can talk about it. But Scott is, I think, on the tail end of what people have called like his paranoid thriller era. Because the film he makes just before this is Enemy of the State.
Right.
Starring Will Smith and Gene Hackman, which is possibly his worst film, and possibly, I think, one of the worst films ever made. I rewatched that film recently, and it's terrible. So we saw Tony Scott 4 films ago. It's True Romance, Crimson Tide, the submarine film, The Fan, like a very unpleasant kind of stalker film with De Niro and Snipes.
That's not the name of the Travolta Fred Durst film, is it?
The Fanatic
is probably better than The Fan, to be honest. Enemy of the State, and now he's at Spy Game. And the interesting thing is, this is just before what I think is the perfect run of Scott's filmography up until his death. Because after this, he makes Man on Fire. Have you seen Man on Fire, Sam?
I've seen half of it. It's the start of the Denzel run, right?
Yes, yeah. Exactly. So it's Man on Fire, Domino, which he makes with Keira Knightley, which is great, based on the true story of Norman Bates from Psycho. What's his name? Anthony Perkins's daughter. That's what Domino is about. Deja Vu with Washington, Taking of Pelham 1-2-3 with Washington, and Unstoppable.
Deja Vu is the great one.
Right? Yeah, Deja Vu is great. Although you said you watched Unstoppable.
Yeah, I liked Unstoppable. I kept on hearing good things about it, and then I finally got around to it and was like, oh, this is good.
Yeah, I think Quentin Tarantino recently said it's one of his favorite films of all time.
There you go.
It's like a runaway train movie, co-starring one of the Chrises. Which is it? Is it Pine?
It's the best one. It's Pine.
Yeah.
The best by far.
Yeah, that's true.
I was only like, I just wish this took place on a plane. It's yeah. Like the trains were a bit...
bit iffy. There is that really good Liam Neeson plane movie. Have you seen that one?
Oh, man, I've written about that movie. I love that movie. Non-stop.
Non-stop.
Is that it? Yeah, that movie is insane.
Yeah, it really... I mean, have you seen Non-Stop?
No, I have not.
Not to ruin Non-Stop for you. The twist of that film is that the antagonists are the relatives of people who died in 9/11.
Yeah.
It has a 9/11...
They're army vets or something. That's and they're like, right. They want... They. It's crazy. That
yeah.
It, who's that director?
Jean-Calais Sarah or something? Yeah,
he's a real Tony Scott guy, right? Yeah. Like this genre filmmaker who's like a stealth high stylist.
Yeah.
Like really great filmmaker. Yeah. All of those guys... That guy's films, they're all great.
Because he made the Blake Lively Shark movie.
Awesome film.
A fantastic film.
The Commuter.
Yeah.
And did a train one.
Yeah, he did a train and a plane. Didn't he do the late night crime one with Ed Harris? Run All Night or something?
That's the one I haven't seen. That guy's great. A legend.
I haven't seen any of his films.
I think he's gone Disney now. I think he's the guy making Jungle Cruise based on
that's
the
where ride. The money
we
is.
Lost him. We lost him.
He's gone.
He wanted a third house.
Yeah, exactly. But Scott is, I think that's a good way to describe Scott, right? That like, while he's making movies, critics are not properly respecting the guy's clear auteurism, which I think you see in a film like this, because I keep coming back to it, but like it wants to be a 70s paranoid thriller, but Tony Scott is incapable of making that kind of film. So he has sped up footage, smash cuts to kind of like title cards accompanied by like
those are so
stunning
funny.
Sound.
Because there's 24 Hours to Save Brad Pitt, which is... Basically, it seems, in terms of tension, left aside because the film was made through flashbacks, but you're gradually reminded of it through these, like, hammering black and white title cards that slam the time onto the screen. Which
very
also,
funny.
The time is paced out entirely inconsistently because Redford just, like, sleeps for 5 hours towards the end of the film.
But it's also, like, it's made inert because of the flashbacks. Like, why, like, who's keeping track of the time when you're going back in time 15 years to the Vietnam War? You're like, oh, but it's 5 a.m. where Redford is in present time.
Yeah,
like, it's a 90-minute movie that's 2 hours long.
Yeah.
Like, it's wrong.
You could make a version of this film that is like, this is a movie about the evolution of the CIA. This is, you know, the way that the CIA kind of ingratiates itself in different communities and offsets different wars, and there's Berlin Wall stuff in there as well. But the film, it's completely unwilling to have anything to say about the fact that, I guess it kind of, if you're being generous, it just says it by saying it. Like, it does have a Vietnam War flashback, it does have a Berlin Wall flashback, and it does end with China. So it charts kind of global hotspots of conflict reasonably effectively.
I kind of went into this film like thinking on spy films and going like, are they all just fascist? And, you know, like you enjoy them as a kid and then you like grow up and realize what the world is and you go, oh my God, these films are terrible. What have they, you know, socialized me to think? But I feel like this one sort of falls into the category of the kind of like liberal panic, America is bad, the CIA is the actual enemy kind of genre, but it has like no teeth doing that. But it feels like it's getting, you know, it's starting that kind of era of like the Bourne movie, I think, is the next year. Yeah. Apparently Brad Pitt was supposed to be Jason Bourne.
Is that
this,
right?
I didn't know that. Scheduling conflicts with Spy Game.
Breaking news.
Breaking news from 20 years ago. meant that he couldn't be Jason Bourne, which like then makes that series completely different. But yeah, wow. the Jason Bourne movies, and then Robert Redford made, what was it, Lions for Land?
Yes.
Like,
yes.
That kind of like, and I mean, obviously this is filmed before September the 11th and comes out before September the 11th, but that kind of ratchets all of this stuff up as like, oh, what if we're the bad guys?
Yeah.
And I think, you know, like, I think that that kind of like self-abnegation and reflection is sort of just as much a cop-out as making some fascist spy movie anyway.
I think because it does want to borrow from 3 Days of the Condor the idea of, like, the driving plot force in that film is that the villains are a CIA within a CIA. So there's, like, a different sect of the CIA that are preparing for basically an invasion of Afghanistan that the rest of the CIA don't know about. And this film wants to similarly say there's two CIAs, but it doesn't have the grim 3 Days of the Condor thing where it's like, actually, they're all, either CIA is pretty bad. This film wants to be like, there are people like Brad Pitt and Robert Redford who get the job done, and then there are fucking nerds who don't know what the hell is really going on. I mean, the ostensible antagonist of this film is storied stage actor Stephen Delane, the guy with the very high widow's peak, who plays Leonard Wolfe in The Hours.
Oh, I didn't know that.
He's a Game of Thrones guy, right?
Yeah.
I've not seen Game of Thrones, but I was like, I know that guy from memes.
He's also, I also saw him, he developed and performed in a one-man version of Macbeth, which I saw.
Was it good?
Yeah, it was really good. Although, I saw it at the Opera House when I was 16, so it's like almost 14 years ago now. But whenever he played Lady Macbeth, he would like make her like stroking herself all the time and like doing kissy motions to herself to be like, I am now playing a woman. Like, it was obviously
problematic. Did he put his voice very high?
He translated all her lines into French. So it was odd.
Insane.
but like suitably, I remember it being quite genuinely scary. Like the witch's stuff was really scary.
He's got a scary face.
He does. And I think he's pretty good in this
movie.
I don't think
he knows the plot of this film though. I think he's kind of confused about why anyone is doing anything.
There's kind of like a missing act almost, and this would make it more of that, you know, like kind of CIA eating itself, where he is like more of an outright villain, and he's like trying to get the Brad Pitt character killed by the Chinese to cover something up kind of thing. And he's kind of like got that arch camp kind of villain to him, but it's not at that level. Like, it's a bit more tame than that, which is a good thing. Like, it's a different film if that was the case. But I think he's good, and he's kind of, but I feel like, yeah, I think he wants to chew up the scenery, but he doesn't really know what the motive of the character is.
Well, that's the thing, is like, the motive of the character seems to be not an implausibly correct one, which is not to send a SEAL team into a Chinese prison to rescue someone who seemed to be on a rogue operation to save someone he loved in Beirut. Like, that is not,
he's justified,
obviously the wrong position. Yeah. And so he's skeptical of what Redford is doing, which is because of his, and I guess we'll get to this kind of theme, his love, something like love for Brad Pitt, pulling all these strings.
It's a good time to, I want to read like a tiny bit from the Ignatiy Vishniev review. So Vishniev had always wanted to write about Scott and had written stuff, and then Scott sadly passed away, and Vishniev like pulled together a very long piece that he wrote for Mubi, which is really good. It's called Smearing the Senses, Tony Scott the Action Painter, which is a great title. And he says, no surprise then that Scott's three best late period films, Spy Game, Deja Vu, and The Taking of Pelham 123, are metaphysical romances. A love story between two men, that's how Howard Hawks described A Girl in Every Port. These words also sum up Spy Game and Pelham, an unerotic fraternity that borders on courtship, and which, described in terms of conventional romances, whether straight or gay, would make Spy Game a melancholy sort of breakup and reconciliation. Which is, I think, an accurate reading of what this film wants to do, but there is maybe slightly less interesting stuff going on in that breakup than you'd like there to be.
I want to see that movie. That was not the movie that I saw. That sounds like a great movie.
They do, because they do, Pitt and Redford fall apart basically over a third party, so it does resemble kind of like an affair almost. You're undone by the flashback structure in that you know that Redford ultimately has love for Pitt because he's trying to save him, even as it's being revealed how they broke up.
So why, but I guess why does he love Pitt is my question. I don't know if the film gives a reason, aside from the fact that he was impressed by his capacity and mentored him.
Well, that's the fun meta-textual stuff though, right? Because like...
But you got to have textual stuff as well.
Oh, for sure. I mean, I'm not... I think this is a flawed film, but I think that stuff is interesting. Because Redford and Pitt have worked together before with Redford directing. Redford made A River Runs Through It, which Pitt starred in.
Which so we did not like.
You guys have talked about that.
Yeah. Is have you seen that film?
No, I don't. It's...
I think it's one of the worst films ever made.
Wow.
It's pretty rough.
I mean, yeah, like, I guess there's just this frustrating... They're not meeting in the middle, right? Like, they're not... Redford's bringing it, Pitt's not, so you can't have that kind of the metatextual interchange of, like, the conference and the handing over. And it's weird because I sort of went into it thinking, oh, you know, like, Brad Pitt will be really good in this. Because I don't think Redford sees himself as an actor as much as Brad Pitt does. Like, I think he, at this point, he's made many films and won Best Director, Oscar and stuff. So he's like that. Redford is just like classic leading man. Like, he's, yeah. and he's so good in that thing. And I think maybe he takes over this film a little bit too much because he just is, that's what he does. He's the leading man. Whereas Brad Pitt, and I'm sure you'll talk about this in every episode you record, is the like character actor hiding behind the leading man kind Absolutely. Of thing. So I think he doesn't have anything really to hold on to in this film that then brings them together in the middle to have that exchange and then to create all that subtext that reviewer is bringing into it that I couldn't see, and I would love to see that movie. Yeah. And I kind of thought that this was that movie. I don't know.
I think that's true. I think there does exist a little bit in this film the idea that Redford has been in these 70s paranoid thrillers, so here's a new take on that kind of thing. So you're bringing in the old guy. Actually, a lot like, not to return to it because I don't think it's a very good film, but a lot, that's what the Avengers movie Winter Soldier wants to do too, right? That's deliberately in the mold of, like, you know, All the President's Men. And so you get the guy from All the President's Men there, but he turns out to be bad, so you can reckon with the legacy in all kinds of ways. But
I just got to say, like, how good is coronavirus in terms of living a year without a Marvel movie?
That's true. Yeah. I mean, they've got one in the chamber, right? Oh, they're God. Ready to...
Black Widow, right? I read that because they're putting up all the NBA players in Disneyland so that they can play the NBA unimpeded by coronavirus. They're giving them access to as yet unseen Disney films, including some Marvel films.
That's very exciting. So
if you play for... The Lakers.
What a weird reality. are the NRL players on that island? They're still doing that.
I wish that had like happened.
Whatever Australian film that they're not going to release
Red
in
Dog
cinemas.
3.
Red Dog 3.
Red Dog 3 exists. I think it's Red Dog 4 there.
Oh, okay. Well, look, so if you wanted to write a journal article about, like, if you wanted to go academic about Spy Game, you could make an argument that what is happening is... The reason it doesn't work is Robert Redford is trying to make Brad Pitt a leading man, sees him post A River Runs Through It as the natural heir to the leading man position. Brad Pitt, despite seeming to fulfill that role on a superficial level, actually, firstly, isn't very good at it, and B, doesn't want to do it.
No, doesn't
and
want
so
to do
what,
it.
You literally have that being played out in the film, but because the conflict exists at a kind of perform like a superficial level and a level as to the level as to which the film is referring kind of metaphorically, it just falls apart.
It's
Because Brad Pitt actually doesn't want to be doing... He doesn't want to be in this film.
No.
I just wonder if there's some kind of behind-the-scenes story that would affirm exactly that. Like, I think you're absolutely onto the right thread with it. And whether it's, one, Brad Pitt kind of kicking himself that he's not Jason Bourne and stuck on this set and kind of bored and stoned. Or two, it's like Robert Redford sort of... You know that thing where, like... I'm trying to think of examples, but none will come to mind, but... it's the Tom Cruise thing in Mission Impossible where the film is set up ostensibly to hand over something and then halfway through the actor realizes, no, actually I like this. And I would, and I just, you know, I think there's something about Robert Redford's charm, the kind of like funny metatextual thing that I sort of did laugh out loud during this film was that to kind of signify where we were in the flashbacks, Brad Pitt changed hairstyles, I think, 3 times. Yeah. And Robert Redford's hair did not change a single thread. Yeah. There wasn't, like, one hair out of place the whole time. And I do think that would have been, like, you know, Redford going, you're not touching my hair. Yeah. Whereas, you know, Brad can go through these 3 terrible hairstyles to signify the time, but no one's touching this hair.
Is Brad in the Vietnam scene, is his face... the Irishman at all? Like, is that... I thought they had made him look younger with CGI. It felt like that to me. Maybe it was just a lot of makeup.
He looks pretty consistent to me.
In the first scene in the tent when he first meets Redford, he looks very young.
Really?
Were they doing that back then? That's pretty early.
Yeah, I guess if you can't tell, they're not doing it, maybe.
I think he did... Like, I think Brad looked young... Like, you guys are going to have the way better scope on all of this. But Brad did look younger than I thought he would have been at this time. Like, the acne scars are kind of popping out. And maybe that's just putting him next to Redford, who is entering that kind of, like, beautifully craggy, untouched face kind of period.
Yeah, I don't know.
He does look surprisingly young in this film. He looks, like, younger than... I mean, this film looks like it was made when Brad Pitt was in the kind of Sleepers, the, like, 10 years previous phase. We could have watched that then, and I wouldn't have.
It's so odd that this film is now.
4 years? Like, yeah. Not that long between them, right?
It feels like this is the film that he's in when he's true romance age, and true romance feels like the film he wants to do now.
Yeah, where he's, like, stoner on the sides of the frame, action. Laugh line.
Yeah. That, sadly, the Wikipedia page on Spy Game gives very little in the information. All it says is the film was made in Morocco between November 5th and 2000 to March 19, 2001. Wait, that's a long shoot.
When's it released?
That's a good question.
I think that's why he didn't get born. Like, I think they went over or something.
It's trapped in Morocco. November 21, 2001. So
it's post. It's released post 9/11.
The day before my 11th birthday.
Hmm.
There you go.
Happy birthday,
Joe. November 21. The film made its worldwide premiere at the Mann National Theatre on November 19th, 2001. That's the only other thing the Wikipedia page says.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's got a building explosion, which was controversial. I guess it's not in America, though, so no one cares. But I do... Like, I don't mean to... Like, I think it matters that this is made before 9/11 and released after. I don't think you're making this film in 2002. Right.
No, it's too loaded, right? In the cultural consciousness to be having these discussions.
It's also like, it's about a set of completely different concerns if it's made in 2000.
Well, then it morphs into like Syriana and Zero Dark Thirty and that kind of like, again, the kind of mea culpa sort of genre of films, like, aren't we bad kind of thing. It's almost there though, like, I wasn't sure where it came in the sort of timeline. It's not prescient because it doesn't take any of it seriously. Like, it's all just color and detail. It's there somewhere in the timeline.
Is it set in 2001?
It's the early 90s, isn't it? Because it's like he meets him in 75 in Vietnam, and he says it's 15 years ago. So it's very early 90s.
It's very funny to have an early 90s period piece in 2000.
I mean, was the script written then? Like, did it just bounce around for a long
time? What is the origin of this film? Like, it doesn't... The other thing that I thought it might do was, like, because its title is so on the nose, that it would kind of, like, engage in the spy genre and sort of riff off the genre, but it doesn't feel like it has any kind of cultural understanding of that history of film.
Yeah, it's about as far away as from John Le Carre, as you can imagine.
No, totally. And it touches on Le Carre a little bit in the Berlin stuff, but it's so, like, fast-forwarded through that kind of stuff. Like,
it does want to do the Le Carre also kind of slightly boring, sad older man.
Which is interesting. Yeah, but look, Redford never really. Redford couldn't be a British person.
You don't think Lucari could be in like Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy? Redford, you don't think he could be smiling?
He's too. Too sincere. Or like he's too. He takes his role as a movie star too seriously.
Yeah, it's his likability. Like, there is just something... I'm sure there's nothing to back it up, but, you know, I think he just became rigid in wanting to be super charming in this. And so, and you know, you've got the best head of hair of any human of all time. Like, why wouldn't you? But
he is famously difficult to work with, Robert Redford.
Yeah, I was thinking... Remember, like, he didn't show up to Australia on time for that Cate Blanchett movie?
Yeah, he just... If he doesn't want to shoot, he just won't shoot.
Yeah.
I mean, he's retired now, right? Isn't the old man with the gun?
Right? Yeah.
Boat movie's good. Oh, yeah. All is lost. I like can't that watch movie.
Same movies.
They really? They freak you out too much. My
water is a phobia.
Not in general, but in movies.
Oh.
I feel like because a combination of terrible things can happen that are claustrophobic. And what nothing interesting can happen on the sea, I think, is a kind
what
of...
What do you mean nothing interesting?
I think one of the things that I don't like about Jaws is that it ends at the end on the sea. I want them to go back to the land. I guess this is something I need to interrogate with myself.
Yeah,
it feels dissatisfying to me.
That means you haven't seen Peter Berg's Deepwater Horizon.
Absolutely not.
It's a good film. Okay. The Peter Berg movie. Is Peter Berg kind of Tony Scott? Maybe not. I think he's more sincere.
Was he in this movie? I watched something else and he was in it.
Really? Yeah. Very odd. Weird period of American history in terms of filmmaking. Spy Game was written, so it's got a story by credit of this guy who, like, doesn't have a Wikipedia page. His name is...
What Peter Berg was in Lions for Lambs.
Oh, so...
Easy.
Yeah, I think. Really, that's why it was like, yeah. I rewatched the trailer because I was like, is that film as bad as this?
So Lions for Lambs came out when I was a frequent user of the IMDb message boards. And there was an IMDb message board that I was frequently on called, like, Oscar Buzz, where people... It was just... all year round Oscar talk. And so what that would mean is, obviously, you know, when you're like March and you're far away from the Oscars as possible, people were hyping up films that were about to come out, and there was a Stan-like culture around Lions for Lambs where people were like, I remember in their message by like the signature on their message board when they posted it would say things like, Lions for Lambs, nominated for 12 Oscars, like, for your consideration. Robert Redford, best director, best... And I think...
Free Twitter internet was much better.
And
I think... Are these, like, Robert Redford stat, like, who like him as a director? Is that why they were getting behind that?
Well, isn't Tom Cruise in that movie and Meryl Streep's in that movie?
Tom to get his Oscar.
Are they just Oscar stands? Like, the idea of awards?
Yes, they're like the young lad who you recently called Action Jackson. Lights, Camera, Jackson. Do you know him? He's like a...
He's an insane film reviewer whose virtue used to be his extreme youth, where he was like 7, and now he's like a 14-year-old dude reviewing every single movie on YouTube for like 200 views. Yeah. And he's just...
But his thing is that he evaluates movies by being like, The Irishman, you know, it's a three-hour-long, you know, crime classic. And similarly...
All the stars are out. Yeah. It's like, he's like a weird...
Yeah.
Wait, these don't have... Like, he doesn't have many people watching it?
Not anymore, no. He used to be like, he was on some morning shows, I think, for a while. Yeah. And now just...
We shouldn't talk about him. This is the kind of stuff that, like, gives him some likes.
That's true.
Create a monster.
Joe wanted to try and get him on the show, but I think we've had mouthed
too. I ask that we don't be rude.
Okay.
I have affection for
him. Sincere, I think.
So the guy who made the story credit for this film, Michael Frost Beckner, no idea who that guy is, but the film's script was co-written by David Arata, who years later makes Children of Men, writes Children of Men. That is not a clear through line between these two projects.
That's the real throw thing at the dartboard in any film.
It's possible. I mean, Scott has enough box office clout that he could... basically rewrite this film on the fly if he wanted to. And sometimes I feel like maybe this is a guy who would look at a script. I mean, I love Tony Scott, but I think his most interesting quality as a filmmaker is his heart and his sincerity, and like, he cares about people. That's his biggest draw, particularly when compared to his brother Ridley, who like doesn't care about people.
But is, yeah, like, I mean, watching this, I was it felt like the least Tony Scott movie I'd seen. And it kind of actually, you know, I'm sure people kind of make these comparisons all the time, but it felt more like a Ridley Scott movie from the same period.
Yeah.
Like, what was that, Anonymous?
Body
Russell,
of Life.
Body of Lies, exactly. Yeah. Russell Crowe and Leo. Like, just kind of weirdly, just nothing kind of genre piece that, doesn't have any kind of soul to it. And then also, like, Tony Scott just feels like he's constricted by the boardroom kind of stuff. Like, he's not getting to do all... He just gets that one roof scene, that's all he's allowed.
He does do quite a lot of, like, speed up, slow down footage.
I mentioned this to you just before we recorded, Joe, but it reminded me of Mad Max Fury Road, the kind of, like, rapid, suddenly, like, rapid camera work.
Oh, right.
Just, I kept thinking, I mean, I know...
But out of nowhere.
Yeah.
And not sustained in the way that Mad Max is sustained.
And not speaking to a world.
No.
Just for fun.
Yeah, it was the roof scene and then, like, the final scene of, like, Robert Redford speeding off in his, like, was it a Jaguar or something? And, like, they're kind of, like, it's not, like, early thousands, not new metal, but kind of, like, sort of new metal soundtrack. Oh,
the music cues are fucking bonkers in this film. I don't know why I haven't...
It feels like there's two soundtracks, right? There's the Beirut soundtrack and then there's the... New metal, whatever.
Well, this is the, like, we're about to be racist soundtrack. It opens and I'm like, oh, this film is going to be racist on a black screen with, like, quote-unquote oriental-sounding music, right? Like, it's very... And then you've got some, real cliched soundtracks to signify... When we talked about The Mexican, which is the film we watched last week, we talked about the kind of colour filter. Everything in Mexico is brown when you're in Mexico, and it felt like this, but with music cues, everything. Like, you're going to a foreign country, you have vaguely foreign-sounding music that's associated with it.
The film also does that, like, colour coding for different genres and regions of the world, which is... Didn't you always think, Sam? I always thought the film that popularized that is Steven Soderbergh's Traffic.
Yeah.
But Traffic, even when Spy Game is being made, has only come out the year before. Traffic comes out in 2000.
Yeah.
So maybe Traffic is less guilty of this shit than I thought it was.
Well, but it's more obvious. Like, Traffic is like Steven Soderbergh took the film print and dunked it in cordial or something. It's so, like, it's bleached out. This is just kind of lazy. Yeah. Like, it doesn't feel like a huge aesthetic, bold decision. It's just shorthand for, this isn't the current moment.
And this is not America.
Yeah.
Do you like Soderbergh?
I love Soderbergh. I'm a Soderbergh nut.
Mm-hmm.
I just realized I've probably seen almost all of them.
Really?
Yeah.
That's a lot of movies as well.
Yeah, well, over the years, like, new one comes out and I'll rush to Soderbergh.
Have you seen the weird ones, like, I haven't seen stuff like Bubble.
I haven't seen Bubble.
He made for like $20,000 on his iPhone.
And I'm hesitant to go and, like, track those ones down. I've started, like, tracking down the 90s ones that no one's seen. I watched,
Full Frontal, have you seen that one?
No. Now it's going to sound like I haven't seen any of them. what did I see? There was the one before Out of Sight I watched recently, which was like a little crime caper.
I've never seen Out of Sight, but people say it's unbelievable.
Oh, yeah, you have to see Out of Sight. I loved High Flying Bird last year. That was great.
That I watched that in a hotel room in Japan. That movie baffled me. I think because I didn't understand enough about basketball. I don't know. I found that very...
I love sped up dialogue so quick.
Mm.
Yeah. But I like the directors who, you know, just jump genres out of interest. I had this interesting conversation with a friend the other day who's a filmmaker, and she has sort of just really, like, is grasping with Altman at the moment and had seen Nashville and just fallen completely in love with it. But I think Altman's at actually, like, an even higher tier where he's not even jumping genres after a certain point, but he's just, like, interested in, you know, certain parts of humanity and certain kind of, like, industries. I watched for the first time The Company, the ballet film he made with Neve Campbell, which is just, like, astounding. Yeah. Such a good movie and something that people totally slept on. But that kind of, you know, Altman, Soderbergh, even David Gordon Green, when he does his stoner movies after doing, like, really beautiful lyrical indie romances. I like that because I think that's what interests me about filmmaking, but also writing as well, is, like, not getting stuck on any one thing, like, you know, being able to skip across things. I mean, Dan, I really loved your piece on, I don't know how you did it, managed to wrangle a word count out of that Jeff Dyer.
Oh, thank you. Yeah.
Jeff Dyer book.
Yeah, like, that was rough.
How anyone had anything to say about that book. But, but you know, like the Dyer kind of writer is similar to the, you know, the kind of like genre hopping filmmaker. You know, and Tony Scott and Ridley Scott in a certain way fall into that category. Like, who knew that Tony Scott would want to make a spy movie? But, and I mean, it's barely a spy movie, but, you know, that he was... There's an intellectual interest behind it that generates a work rather than skipping through scripts and finding something that you want to make. You know.
Soderbergh is, I think, the wildest example of that. Because as you say, Altman did it, but Altman is also... Altman is so distinctive in so many ways that, like, every Altman film is an Altman film before it's like a... You know, what's that gambling movie he made? I keep wanting to call it Mississippi Grind, but I think that's the Ben Mendelsohn movie.
Yeah, that is the Ben Mendelsohn. California Split.
California Split.
That's a great movie. I only watched that one last year, I think.
I love that film. Like, that's a gambling film, but it's an Altman film before it's anything else.
It's his ragtag cast.
Yeah. You know, Whereas Soderbergh is... I mean, we're reckoning with him next week. Ocean's 11 is next.
Oh, right? Yeah, of course. And
I was trying to think, who are the directors that Pitt works with more than once? And I think there's only three of them. I think it's Fincher 3 times, Soderbergh 3 times,
and Scott twice.
And Tony Scott twice.
Is Soderbergh just the...
just the Oceans?
Literally just the Oceans.
Because, like, yeah, because Soderbergh does more stuff with Damon and Clooney, right? Yeah. Like, he does multiple...
He's best buds with Clooney. So when I was looking at Soderbergh's filmography in order, I wondered if whether these days, like, changing up the size of the projects he makes and the kind of projects he makes comes from that early string of failures. I think on the last episode we were talking about the fact that, like, Steven Soderbergh's, like, first 4 films after Sex, Lies, and Videotape just fail terribly. Like, stuff like Kafka that makes no money. And then he has Traffic and Aaron Brockovich in the same year, competes against himself for Best Director, and then Forever After it's like, I'll do anything. One thing sticks in my head all the time that he said in an interview once. He was like, we should use Netflix as like a backup in that, like, when I see the first box office receipts from the first weekend, I can tell if my film's going to be a failure or not. So what we should do is, like, if he was talking about, it's the film he made that's, like, set in a psychiatric hospital.
Oh, I love that one as well.
It's
Unsafe?
Unsafe. Yeah,
terrible title.
Yeah,
terrible that's title. A great movie, though. Yeah. People slept on that one, too.
Well, that's the thing. He was like, when Unsafe came out and it debuted at, like, number 8 on the box office, what I want to be able to do is go, like, okay, let's immediately pull it and put it straight to Netflix now.
Yeah.
Because no one's going to see it at the cinema. Yeah.
But then he sort of, like, starts making Netflix movies, and though High Flying Bird was great, he releases another one in the same year, The Laundromat, which is his worst film.
I watched half of that. Couldn't handle it.
So bad.
Yeah.
And he's making another film with Meryl Streep, I think, for Netflix, and it's like, oh, this isn't going to be some, like, I don't care, I'm just going to dump these things online kind of era. But, you know, High Flying Bird gives me hope, at least.
He did you read the interview with him, too, where he said, like, since quarantine, I've written 11 scripts. So that, can you imagine? Wow. Do we have any final thoughts before we play the Letterboxd game?
There's not much to say about that movie. I would recommend to people to track down... You know Robert Foster from The Go-Betweens?
Mm.
Yeah.
His only piece of published writing before he became the music critic for The Monthly and, like, wrote for them for a number of years and then published a couple of books, it was in 1987 he wrote a piece about hair care for a magazine called, I think it's Debris, and it has one paragraph, it's not a very long piece, but on Robert Redford's hair, questioning, you know, whether he uses dye, and, you know, I think he just shampoos, I don't think he conditions, just to, like, just this obsessive piece about Robert Redford's hair.
That's amazing.
Which is great, and, you know, and Robert Foster has, you know, is a hair icon himself for many years.
Anyway, I rewatched 3 Days of the Condor, as I've said, like, 10 or 12 times for some reason, and then rewatch Parallax View. And Parallax View, Warren Beatty's hair is, like, this. Like, the best hair of Beatty's career.
Oh,
and then... Look at that! Fucking... And then I saw, where was it? It just came up. And then Redford's hair is also like all-time great in 3 Days of the Condor. So maybe there's something about like 70s paranoid spy thrillers that's really good for your hair.
Which one was first? Was 3 Days?
That's a very good question. Because
I feel like Beatty's copying Redford there. Really? Because Redford's hair just doesn't change after that.
That's true.
That's like I do think that's kind of what went wrong with Spy Game. Was Redford was like, no one's touching my hair. Brad Pitt can go through the changes. Brad Pitt got pissed off because he had to cut his hair 3 times for his movie. And that's where the tension went out of the room.
3 Days of the Condor was 1975. It's also extremely exciting to me that 3 Days of the Condor was based on a book called 6 Days of the Condor.
We've got to make it snappy.
Yeah. What happened to those 3 days?
That's the power of cinema. You lose 3 days. Parallax View was the year before, 1974.
Yeah, right. Maybe there was on-set spying.
Yeah. That's very true. Dan, do you have any...
I want to emphasize... I go into these films with an open heart, but I...
No, you don't.
No, I do. You should see me before I watch them. It was like, I wanted to like this movie. I like a propulsive thriller. It wasn't propulsive enough for me, but I really do think, to go back to what I was saying before, that the music cues kind of really forcefully turned me off this film, because they are so bombastic and so assertive and so cliched and corny that I just ended up reading that back into the film, because there's so much about this film that I think could have been good.
Totally.
But there's this sense of non-self-reflective corniness that I couldn't even find pleasure in its earnestness. Because when Redford is finally triumphantly leaving the CIA after pulling some complex scheme that allowed him to free Pitt,
lied about his ex-wife.
Yeah, like, oh, there's a reference that Pitt is his fourth wife, which kind of alludes to his, you know, profound love for Pitt. And he pretends he had to transfer money in order to bribe someone to allow the power to be shut down to prison, blah blah blah. And this is kind of being discovered in the CIA, and he is kind of walking out to his car. There's like a children's choir playing that's turned up so loud. Like, the sound mixing on all the score on this film is bonkers. It's just like telling you what to feel all the time.
Mm.
But I never felt driven to feel anything in this film, really. I like the idea of love between Pitt and Redford, but it never... And the ending, there's like, I was a little moved in the kind of intercuts between Pitt and Redford as the kind of... But only at, like, maybe as I'd be moved by like a soap commercial or something.
Damn. I think I found the most...
You found things to love in this film, right? Quite... Even though you think it's flawed.
I think it's deeply flawed, but I think ultimately I'm too fascinated by the idea of someone like Tony Scott trying to make a paranoid thriller and just like tripping themselves up. Mm. In aesthetic ways and in kind of thematic ways.
Mm.
That he can't do the bleakness, like, because it's cares sweet. About human beings yeah. too much. I think that's a problem with the film, but an interesting problem. I also think it's extremely sweet that there's one scene in Redford's office where he's standing in the doorway and there's a coat rack behind him on which is hanging Tony Scott's own extremely distinctive red cap. Like, every photo of Tony Scott, he's wearing this hat.
Red cap's now washed, off the like, table.
Washed out. Is it the same cap? Did you just have the same cap?
It must be, so like, the out. Very... Yeah, I mean, this is his...
Oh, God.
Right? Like, he's wearing that on the red carpet.
And then Trump came along and...
Yeah, ruined red hats for everyone.
Red hats. I think, you know, like, I think this film just... It lives and dies by Redford.
Mm.
Like, the good parts about it, the charming, like, and the kind of, like, weird covert stuff in the CIA are all Redford. And then, yeah, there's some kind of tension to it that I think that Redford overtook it. Because there's also, like, there's many different, like, films within it that could have been better. I mean, you know, we didn't even talk about... Charlotte Rampling's in it for
one second.
Yeah. David Hemmings, who seems ready to like chew up the scenery as well, is in it for at least 2 scenes. But there's an ensemble version of it, but I just don't think you get that with the kind of star wattage of Redford, who ultimately, like, you know, blocked out Pitt in a weird way.
Give me a scene that is one of the flashbacks. Give me a movie, rather, that is one of the flashbacks.
Yeah.
Like, that would be fine.
Maybe.
At least. Or make it chronological. Yeah. You know, yeah. It's about the recruitment and the intergenerational kind of, like, conflict between those two characters.
Yeah.
Or just give me the Redford, you know, doing the covert stuff in the single building, which is, you know, like, shouldn't be, you know, marked down, because that stuff's actually, that was kind of tense and weird and sort of funny.
Yeah.
Too many films in one, though.
I think it's true. I hadn't thought of that. But the film that's just, like, Robert Redford trying to save a protege in an office that's set entirely in the office, and maybe you get, like, a single shot of the person at the end. You see them in, like, a news... So you don't even know who he's trying to save. That's just... That's a, such an interesting film compared to this one. So Letterboxd game. So I wanted to do just quickly, like, a very negatively rated review from a person who... So usually Letterboxd game will read out the person's top four films. We can't do this with this person because they have logged one film on Letterboxd before abandoning the app altogether.
And it was Spy Game?
According to this person's profile, they have watched a single film and it is Spy Game. They gave it half a star. They said, "Oh man, what a turd of a film. This is by far and away the ugliest and dumbest directed movie I've seen for a long time."
The only one.
It has multiple flashbacks, one in which Redford is training Pitt to be a spy in West Berlin in 1976, mostly by ensuring he's always looking at what's behind him in shiny teapots. This is called tradecraft. In one of these flashbacks, Brad Pitt has frosted tips. So kind of a shame that this person quit Letterboxd, because that's a reasonably good...
It's a good summation of the film.
Should we do a five-star?
I'd be interested in hearing what a person who loves this film sounds like.
Yeah.
And who they are.
This is such a good idea.
It's we try and find people who most disagree with us and kind of try and work out, like, what is going on.
And what their favourite four films are.
So you can click on Letterboxd, like, either end of the score.
Yeah, which is fantastic. Really clever. So this person's name is Carl Wesley Anderson. I only laugh because their associated Twitter URL is Born to Blaze, which is pretty funny.
Is this, like, gonna be the, like, oh yeah man, Brad Pitt's such a stoner, he's so fucking stoned in this movie, you totally ruined it.
I love
my bro.
I mean, so this person's top four films are
Harold and Kumar.
Yes. No, this person's top four films give a distinct portrait of the kind of person who likes this film, because they are Mel Gibson's Braveheart, so, like, middle of the line American big budget epic. Les Miserables, the new one.
Oh, wow.
So, middle of the line, American big budget epic. Master and Commander, the Far Side of the Russell World. Crowe
fan. Respect. Yeah. That is a great film.
It is a great film. Peter Weir. Where's Peter Weir?
Yeah, come back, Peter.
When was his last film? Like 10 years ago?
Yeah, no one's campaigning for that.
I think maybe I just saw Russell Crowe retweet, like, a 15-follower person who said this, but was there buzz around a Master and Commander 2?
I remember Crowe tweeting, like, if enough interest is generated, we'll make another one.
Yeah, right.
Well, did they get Paul Bettany back? I hope so, right?
Yeah, because there's hundreds of those novels, aren't there?
Yeah.
Like Patrick O'Brien series.
And this person's fourth favourite film, a good movie that, like, nobody talks about, David Mamet's 2004 Spartan. Have either of you seen Spartan?
No.
What's his name? Val Kilmer, CIA, like, rescuing a kidnapped girl movie. Very strange film. Anyway.
This is a pointless story because I haven't even read it, but apparently there was an insane interview with Val Kilmer recently.
Mm.
Who was very sick.
Yeah.
And said, I saw an excerpt from the interview where he said that the only reason he like can't talk, he's been so sick. The only reason he got treatment is because his daughter wanted him to.
Yeah.
But he's a Christian scientist. And he's like, but I'm fine because of my Christian science, despite being extremely ill.
I didn't realize he was a Christian scientist.
I think that's what it is.
Fucked up.
Yeah.
Fucking shit. That is so evil, that religion. What the hell?
Yeah.
Him and J.D. Salinger, right?
Yeah.
Was Salinger a Christian scientist?
That stuff will kill you because, like, go to the doctor.
Yeah.
Crazy. And to do it, oh man, to be a Christian scientist in this point in time, maybe.
Not good environment for anti-medical.
The first I knew that Kilmer was sick was when I saw the what's his name? Thomas Alfredson directed film The Snowman.
Oh boy.
Because
they had to dub him.
Which is recent,
they had to dub him, and it doesn't work. And I was like, what is going on here?
The Christian Science stuff is like annoying because otherwise he seems to be in this like really cool place. In the
moment.
That profile is great. Like, you definitely should read it. And it'll make you want to write one of those profiles. Like, track down some star of yesteryear who's just like gone complete kook. And,
like the Johnny Depp one a while ago.
But not a gotcha. Like, that was
no, kind that of was gotcha, the Gwyneth. There was that Gwyneth Paltrow one that was also kind of a gotcha, where that woman like hung out with her. And, I mean, Gwyneth Paltrow deserves to be taken down,
as does Johnny. But
yeah,
maybe I'll be the one who writes that about Cameron Diaz.
Yeah,
we're talking about doing the Cameron Diaz podcast after the Brad
Pitt. Oh, cool! I was going to ask, like, you know, because Val would be good, but Cameron would be.
Val would be good.
You're gonna have crossover with Cameron though.
Right? Yeah, we have. She was in Being John Malkovich
and The Counselor.
Yeah.
Oof,
won't say a word.
Carl Wesley Anderson's review with those top four films is one of the best spy movies ever. Brilliant directing, writing, and acting. So he loves it all.
I love. It's not a spy movie, though.
No,
it's not
a spy movie.
It's a war movie, I think, more than anything else.
I wonder if this person knows what directing, writing, and acting are.
No, Dan. This person... So this is an incredible review. We'll do this one and maybe one more. Should we just do two more five-star reviews?
Yeah, I'm interested in five-star.
This person's name is Steve Perry Fan 82, and their profile picture is the Canon Films logo. So they are, like me, a lover of trash. And the top four films are Toby Hooper's The Fun House, Toby Hooper's The Texas Chainsaw Massacre, Demons. Have you seen Demons? That's a pretty good... That's like evil spirits come out of a TV screen, directed by Lamberto Bava. Good film. And a film I've never heard of called Intruder, a 1989 slasher film.
Unusual to come across a slasher you haven't...
Never even heard of it. I don't even know this director, Scott Spiegel. And as you say, like, all I do is hoover up slasher films. So I've got... Oh, he's the director of Hostel Part 3. Anyway, very, very odd. This person's review we had to do because it's just so sweet. Saw this in the theatre two nights in a row. Love and miss you, Tony Scott.
Oh,
that's nice.
I respect that.
I miss him too.
So, like, he'd seen it after Tony Scott had died and they did a revival screening?
Or maybe he re-logged it.
Oh, right.
Logged it, like, long after Scott.
Right.
God,
but you saw this in the cinema twice.
I feel like that is something that is no longer in this era. We're not going back to the movies twice in a row.
Back to the movies.
That's true, at all. But when there was... Like, there was more of a sense that, like, maybe you'll have to spend, like, $40 on a VHS, or you'll maybe catch it on TV one night, a TV version that you have to sit through commercials for. Mm. You'd go to the movies twice, see something you thought was... You'd take someone... I don't know. It doesn't happen anymore.
Weirdly, the film I think I've seen most at the cinema... I wish it was something cooler, but I saw Gravity, like, six times at the cinema... I mean, I was going through some stuff, but like, I think I watched it and then I walked out of the cinema and I went and I watched it again. And I think that was not so much because like, I thought this was high art. It was more that I was like, this is a film that will be less good at home on a small screen.
Mm.
Oh, yeah.
So I need to drink up this singular opportunity.
Mm.
Our last review, top four films. Clue. I have never seen Clue. Have you seen Clue, Sam? I've
seen Clue.
Is it good? I know people love
fun.
It.
It's pretty fun. It's not as like amazing as you'd think.
Okay.
And the like multiple endings is less fun than you'd think as well. Yeah. But it's pretty fun. There's just funny people in it.
It was like literally if you went to a different screening you got a different ending.
Yeah, I think so.
Oh.
Yeah.
Based on the board game?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Tim Curry's in it, right?
Yeah. Wow. Madeline Kahn.
Yeah.
And Jason Ritter, maybe? I don't know. Anyway, there's some really good people in it.
People adore it, but I've never seen it. Casino Royale?
The original? That would be a real...
Is Woody Allen in the original?
Yeah.
Everyone's in the original.
Yeah.
Like awesome. 30
people. Yeah.
Woody Allen actually does have a good line in that movie. He's like... because he plays the villain right at the end. There's multiple villains. Orson Welles is one of the villains. It's bizarre. But Woody Allen's like... normally I'd run amok, but I'm too tired, so I'm just going to walk amok. And it's just, it doesn't mean anything when you say it out loud, but when it's said in a movie.
Yeah, Woody Allen should have been cast as villains more frequently, I think.
Yeah.
It would have, he's, He's literally villainous.
He doesn't work in anyone else's movies, though, really, does he?
He's on... did I talk about this on the podcast? He's on Alec Baldwin's podcast. You did talk about it.
Did you listen to the episode?
No, but I listened to another podcast that makes fun of... Then, like, listen to some, and there's this incredible moment. I may have... Anyway, I'll say it again. There's a wonderful moment where Baldwin's like, who are some actors you've worked with? And he's like, oh, I've worked with so many great actors. Scarlett Johansson, Naomi Watts, Emma Stone. He just, like, lists these set of beautiful young women and just can't... And then he's like, oh, I haven't worked with many men because I just cast myself.
I guess that's true.
One of my great regrets in life is I actually saw Woody Allen in New York and...
playing clarinet?
No, I saw him walking down the street. Oh, okay. And he was walking with Dick Cavett and they were talking. Oh, wow. And my great regret is not going up to both of them and going, oh my God, Dick Cavett, can I get your signature?
Yeah.
That would have been so good. He had... because you're embedded in Cassavetes too, aren't you? And that Cassavetes Cavett interview for Husbands, where
I haven't seen that. Oh, they're all tanked, right?
Yeah, Peter Falk, right?
Is it cringy or is it?
It's pretty upsetting.
It's upsetting because Cassavetes is like, maybe I've said this on the podcast too. We did just talking ourselves in circles. That Cassavetes is embodying this role of toxic masculinity. Like, he's being very over, he's like, they bully Cavett off the stage and then the audience start chanting for him to come back. Mm. And there's just like at one point Cassavetes says something like, I want to talk seriously, but he can't do it. It's a case study in like, which is particularly...
But they, like, apologise afterwards, right?
Yeah.
I think, and it's, there's a formal apology made.
But they're there to talk about Husbands, which is a film about, like, tanked men kind of destroying each other.
Mm.
This person's last two favourite films. That Thing You Do. I really like that film.
I've seen it. This is one of the only films, it's come up before, that I have seen and Joe hasn't. Maybe the only film that I've seen and Joe hasn't.
I don't know.
Tom Hanks directed. I think it's fun. Have you?
No. Yeah. I feel like I've watched part of it on TV.
It's got a catchy song written by the, rest in peace, with lead singer Fountains of Wayne. Wrote the soundtrack.
Wow.
And then That Thing You Do is supposed to be a smash hit, like, pop song, and it works. Like, it sounds like I think it's set in the 60s. Maybe 70s. Looks it sounds 60s. Like a smash hit pop song.
Wow.
That's a solid, fun film.
Did you watch it on VHS as a kid?
No, I watched it. A friend of mine was staying with me and we were looking for something to watch. And she's American. She was like, you've never seen That Thing You Do? Crazy.
Hmm.
And so she was baffled that I hadn't seen it.
Yeah,
and so I think I
have seen it.
But it shined through with Tom Hanks's kind of charm.
Hmm.
It's not like a masterpiece, but Sunday afternoon watch.
Huh. And this person's fourth favourite film, Return of the Jedi.
Sure.
So extremely... But
not the other ones. Return of the Jedi.
Yeah.
Yes, that's great. Exactly. That's great. So good.
That's my favourite film when I was 11, I think.
So I chose this person because of this review.
This is a 5-star, right?
This is a 4.5 okay. star. There's not many 5-star reviews of Spy Game. You might be shocked to learn. Spy Game is a film that depicts a number of the realistic things that actual spies might do. Now, I don't think that's true.
No, I haven't got it.
I don't think there's anything that in this film.
No.
What makes Spy Game shine as something special is the way it integrates a framing sequence and flashbacks. So we disagree with all of this so far. I have never seen a film that executed this kind of story structure so seamlessly. There is so much going on, and so many times a character says one thing when he means something completely different. I'm anxious to watch Spy Game again, just to put all the pieces together. It is great. And then this person obviously does, like, where they rank their favourite films against each other. So they're saying, this film wins against Sweeney Todd, the Demon Barber of Fleet Street. wins against Pride and Prejudice, wins against Quantum of Solace, loses to Midnight in Paris, and loses to Tropic Thunder.
What a strange collection of films. None of which are in this person's top four.
No.
Do you think that's why the guy went and saw it again? Do you think maybe there is, like, a viewing of this film where they're... Oh, man, there's also, not. There isn't.
All those films are, like, right, early 2010s? Like, Pride and Prejudice, or mid-2010s?
Pride and Prejudice is earlier
which,
than...
Which Pride and Prejudice?
They're all 2000s. Like, Quantum of Solace is 2008.
And yeah.
Tropic Thunder. Is he doing the same? He's ranking them in a year? Are they all 2008?
Unfortunately, he provides us with... Not enough information.
Oh, mystery.
I mean, Midnight in Paris is maybe a bad film. He also, there's just a line here at the bottom where it just says The Secret Life of Walter Mitty. So,
God. What a signature. What a sign off.
Do you ever worry that these people are going to listen to this?
I made a friend through this game. Like, oh, I found someone who I talk to now.
Isn't it like the people who like give Spy Game 5 stars are going to... This is going to be the only podcast of all time about Spy That's Game. They're going to be like, oh my God, they're Spy metrics. They get a little Google alert, Spy Game podcast, and then they listen to you two dragging them at the end.
I do think that we've said this before, but I think... weirdly, the people who listen to this podcast are not fans of Brad Pitt or his movies broadly, because right. we are meaner about Brad Pitt than some people would like.
Yeah,
which is a crazy thing to say. That we is adore true.
We
him,
love Brad Pitt,
but we don't always. We can be critical of him.
Yeah,
because you're taking the whole view, and like if you go through someone's entire filmography, like you're going to have to sit through some total dreck.
I mean, Brad Pitt's critical of himself.
Yeah, Brad Pitt thinks. It's crazy. We've done like 30 episodes of this podcast and Brad Pitt still doesn't think we're at the stage that he's a good actor. He says it's post-Troy.
Post-Troy.
So like what, 4 films away.
What happens after Troy?
I have to look it up now because that's a very good question. I don't think we know. Does he have any oceans after? Because he...
Maybe 13.
Oh, he's not... Yeah, he's just chewing gum in those movies.
Yeah.
He does. Well, he's not proud of
he
himself.
He asked for that. Ocean's 11. He said, I want to be eating in every scene. He makes the request.
What the fuck are we going to talk about Ocean's 13, Dan? That's
a good question.
Like, I feel like we've got to make sure we don't, like, front load our Ocean's 11 talk.
Are those films... Like, we don't get many films in between, right?
No. They're like... yeah, I know.
I'll be interested for the Ocean's 12, like, because there seems to be a critical reappraisal of that. And I was, like, quite excited to... watch it with that in mind.
Is that your favourite one?
No, I was like, why are people doing this? It's so bad. It's such a nonsense movie.
Is 12 the one... Where's the one in which Robert plays herself?
12.
Yeah. Is it 12?
Oh, yeah. I think I've seen 11 and 12.
That, yeah, because doesn't it have the joke that they're like, oh, you look so much like her?
Yeah, it's so... It doesn't work.
That's
it's
right.
Really strange.
I saw both those at the movies.
Oh, so that... Okay, so there's the thing. It's Troy, Ocean's 12... Mr. and Mrs. Smith. So not
you're not doing great, Brad.
But is it like he becomes a movie star? Like, I feel like Mr. and Mrs. Smith is like huge.
Hit. That's true. And maybe he feels comfortable on set. I mean, he feels pretty comfortable on set.
And went like, and then he starts doing the like more art house again. Though.
That's yeah. that's when does that's that Babel, 2006.
Okay,
maybe one of his worst films, IMO. But I mean, we'll get to
I
it.
I haven't seen it.
And then he's got one more Ocean's 13 in 2007, but then it's Assassination of Jesse James.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
Burn After Reading, Curious Case, Inglorious Bastards.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or
Mega Mind.
I'm looking forward to
you're
that.
On a good, you're on a good run then.
Yeah, finally.
Yeah.
Tree of Life, Moneyball, Killing Them Softly, which it's I think good. Is his
he
best
does,
film.
He does.
It's yeah. nice. It's a good way to do this podcast is do the shit stuff first.
Yeah,
it's like
true.
Warm up.
But it's, yeah, I mean, it's a later takeoff than you would imagine, right? Like, you think he's been in films
yeah.
since the early 90s, and you think of him as kind of like a 90s heartthrob, but he isn't really in
no.
anything that memorable.
No. I think his reputation is better these days than it's ever been.
Yeah, totally.
Definitely.
And I don't think that's just because there's been a critical reappraisal. I think it's because the movies are better.
Mm.
Yeah, I don't think there has been a critical reappraisal. Like, I haven't heard anyone talking about his early stuff.
No, no one's like, oh, we underestimated him
yeah.
then. We're like, he's who he was always meant to be.
Yeah, and like... But he seems like someone who's interested in filmmaking and as much as like supporting stuff getting made
yeah.
And using his clout to be in interesting stuff and working with interesting people. But it feels like it took him longer to get there. And maybe, you know, he had that Fincher connection for a while that worked. But yeah, I don't know. It's a weirder career than you think.
It's generally true too. We were talking about Angelina Jolie recently, right? That like... You look at that filmography and you're like, what's the best movie that Angelina Jolie's ever been in? They're mostly bad. They're mostly like, unless you're ride or die for like Salt, that Philip Noyce directed thriller.
This hit me the other day where it was like, Toni Collette has been in better movies than Cate Blanchett.
That's
and
right.
I think that's something about
like
consistently.
Yeah,
consistently better. More diverse, more That's interesting, true. And, you know, and I think it's just the different style level as well. Like, if you're pitching yourself as one thing rather than the other, it's just, or if you have, you know, you have less creative control, but you are selected for more things. It's just a different, it is really, like, I do find it super fascinating.
Yeah. And stardom can be bad for you. It can mean that your films are
and it makes the stakes much higher, right? Like, if someone has to pay $20 million for you to be in their movie, they're only going to do it with
a film that appeals to the most people. Tony Collette podcast would be a good idea too. That's right. True. That is an interesting,
because then it's like, then you get the Aussie connection. That's true. You get to be like more at home. You could get like some of the people on that she's worked with and stuff.
I have convinced myself that we'd be able to get Andrew Dominik and David Mitchell on this podcast.
They probably just live down the street. No, do the... I'm going to be barracking for you guys. Do the Tony Collette podcast. You should do a vote off Cameron or Tony.
Yeah. That's a great idea. That's true. Or Ben Mendelsohn, if we're doing Australian. That would be wild.
I've seen a lot of those, because I was going to write a Ben Mendelsohn follow-up.
Really?
Because I did Russell, I did Hugh Jackman, and then I was going to do Ben, and I still might do it. I've got notes for it, but I watched like 37 of them.
Really?
Yeah, you would be in for a rough stretch with some of the earlier Australian ones.
Also the later ones, right? When it's like Ready Player One.
And
when he's like this,
the villain. Robin Hood.
He hasn't come out of it yet. Have you seen Sample People?
No.
The like 2000 where it's so frustrating because Kylie Minogue's in it, and they were in this show together as kids. They're both their first like acting jobs, and they don't share a single scene together in this like thing made 20 years later, and it's really, really frustrating, and it's like one of the worst Australian films you'll ever see.
Sample People.
Yeah. See, it's worth doing like Mendelsohn or like Tony Collette, because you get really to go through these like forgotten Australian films that, you know, I mean, every Australian film's forgotten except for Muriel's Wedding and Priscilla.
Yeah.
And you just get to, dig
Mullet.
Through these.
Wasn't Mendelsohn in like a coming-of-age film called Mullet?
No, Mullet's great. Mullet's actually... Mullet is awesome. I saw Mullet was filmed in Kiama, and I saw it down in Huskinson, and that's a great, great film. Mendelsohn's like kind of Fincher in his career is David Caesar, who did Mullet. And
that's right.
Idiot Box is great. Yeah. No, do an Australian person.
That's a very good person.
That's compelling.
Tony is Tony would be so good.
Tony would mean we get to talk about Hereditary, which is all timer for me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Triple X, Return of Xander Cage. She's so good in that.
Is she in that movie?
She's so good.
I don't think I knew that.
Man, Tony, just limitless.
Limitless potential.
Yeah.
thank you so much for joining us for 90 minutes of Spider-Game talk. Sometimes we talk longer than the running times of the film, and that's a bit concerning.
This is how long Spider-Game should have been.
This is
too long. This has been too long. Yeah. Like, this is the exact point when Spider-Game should have ended.
Yeah. Shut up. Sam, thank you so much for joining.
Thanks for having me. Good luck with the rest of the run.
Thank you so much. Do you have anything you'd like to advertise, plug?
My book is called The Rapids. It came out a couple of years ago, but it's getting re-released in North America.
Amazing.
Through University of Toronto Press. And you can pre-order it on their website, and it's got a new introduction, so it's fun.
Who wrote the introduction? Are you allowed to
say? I wrote it. Oh, okay. Like a preface, like a new preface there.
Exciting.
Yeah, it's weird coming back to something that's already been out. You know, and it's like Malibu Barbie with her new hat. But
the new hat works, right? No, that's the point of
the hat's
that.
Pretty good.
Yeah.
Direct people probably to that. Otherwise, that's it.
A Ben Mendelsohn list coming maybe sometime in the
fall. Yeah, I'll get around to that one. I'm sitting on the Gulpilil one as well. I reviewed the Gulpilil biography that came out that's not great. And I watched all of the films. But as you guys know, when you watch someone's entire filmography, it takes a while. And so the relevancy of that being a review of... the Gulpilil book kind of dropped because it took books out, been out for a year now. So hopefully that will come out somewhere soon.
Exciting. Fun. Lovely. Cool. And join us next week for Ocean's 11.
Oh, really? Is that next week?
Yes. Ocean's 11 with special guest Alex Gallagher.
Oh, yeah, exciting.
Alex's favourite film of all time, apparently.
For real? Ocean's 11. Oh, okay.
Have fun.
Exciting.
See you then.
Bye, everyone.